Welcome to Imagining the Past, the Summer-Autumn Season 2025.
HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water and community. We pay respects to Elders past, present and emerging.
In this podcast series, we'll be hearing from some of the sessions from the HNSA conference held in Sydney on the 21st and 22nd of October 2023. In this session, Give Up Your Day Job, Cecilia Rice chats with Sue Williams, Leah Kaminsky and Alison Booth about what attracted them to write historical fiction. And a reminder, these are live recordings, so there are a few lamentable glitches.
To start off with, I'm going to ask each of you to read a little bit from your books. And again, I'll take it in alphabetical order. And luckily, both your first names and second names work in alphabetical order. So that's very helpful. So, Alison, would you like to start? Thank you.
Yes, I'm going to read from the first chapter, which gives a little bit of the background to the story. Is the sound quality all right? Oh, great. So Claire stood on the gravel drive in front of Bellevue. The paintwork around the windows was peeling. Moss was flourishing on the slate roof. And there are splotches of rust on the corrugated iron roof over the veranda. A romantic might think they were like patches of bark on the trunk of a eucalyptus tree, or eroding layers of rock deposited over the millennia. Though she wasn't a romantic, hadn't been one for years, she felt she was going to be happy here. Bellevue had been a safe place for Claire in the past. After she'd lost her husband, Jack, she'd been bereft and without an income, without a home, without a future. But Aunt Hilda had taken in Claire and her young daughter, Sophie. She'd helped them through the crisis, had never asked any questions, and never hurried Claire into reaching a decision. The only thing she'd insisted on was that Claire should go for walks. It was as Hilda was walking the life back into her when she took her and Sophie down into the valleys, along the escarpment, and to the caves with the Aboriginal rock art. Hikes from which Claire returned exhausted, but with a growing acceptance of what had happened. 6 months later, she'd pulled herself together enough to go to the city to try to make a new start. Bellevue had been a safe place in the past, Claire reminded herself again. It would be a safe place in the future, too, and she had Aunt Hilda to thank for this. 87, when she'd passed away, Hilda had been lucid until the end, though she hadn't given Claire any hint that she was to inherit the house. Hilda had left with her solicitor a long and loving letter, and Claire would never forget those words. I feel that you need to put down roots. You never complained after you lost both Jack and your place in Wombat Valley after that terrible accident. But I could see how it was affecting you when you and Sophie lived with me for those months afterwards. If you choose to live in Bellevue, do enjoy it, my dear. But please also keep in mind that you own the house. It doesn't own you. The night after reading the letter, Claire had decided to move up to the mountains in spite of her city friends, who'd thought she was mad to be taking on this decaying old place. My house, she said now as she walked across the damp lawn. She still needed convincing. My place. My home, she said as she strolled past the Montreux cypress pines that looked as if they belonged to another era, like women in hoop petticoats waiting to be asked to dance.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So the next one alphabetically is Leah Kaminsky. Could you please give us a little bit of a reading from Doll's Eye?
sure. Can you all hear me properly?
Yes.
And I do apologize that I'm not there and very sad about it, but yeah, came down with that virus. I'll read a short part from the, this is Doll's Eye, and this is chapter 19, middle of the book, but it goes to the beginning of the story, which is set in Munich in May 1915. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Her left eye looked like it had been licked by some sprite, hidden in the darkness of a new moon. Almost translucent, it was an icy blue mirror in which Gustav Müller saw his own diminished reflection. But the child's right eye was olive green. She slowly drifted off to sleep as he rocked her. Fine veins crisscrossed her lids, behind which her tiny eyes flitted back and forth in wordless dreams. Holding his brand new daughter, he wept tears of love. Andrea. The doctor called it heterochromia, reassuring him that famous people throughout history, the likes of Goethe and Alexander the Great, shared the anomaly. But there was also an ancient belief that a child born with different coloured eyes was the victim of a witch replacing one eye at birth. He vowed then he would do everything in his power to protect his little girl. Those mismatched eyes could be her ticket to the world, but he feared they might also lead her straight to the grave. There are creatures whose children float away as they are born. Gustav would keep his precious daughter Neit, schooling her in literature and languages. He could already hear the taunts of horrid children, calling her hag's child, preying on her otherworldly looks. Her baby heart was beating fast, her little fingers curled firmly around this thumb. The child's warm breath filled his every pore and he felt drunk on his newfound devotion. Careful not to wake her, he gently lowered her into the crib, covering her with a shawl before tiptoeing over to the side of the bed where Ilse lay silent, her face pallid and worn. The child had drained her mother bloodless. Bleary-eyed from lack of sleep, for a chilling moment he thought his wife was dead, but she moved her fingers slowly, beckoning him to come closer. He sat down beside her and held her hand. Several minutes passed in silence before the baby started whimpering. Lifting her from the crib, he lowered her into her mother's arms, and for the first time in days, Ilse smiled. "What shall we call her?" he asked. "Anna," she whispered, "a child of grace." Her voice sounded far away, as if she'd been swept out to sea.
Sue, that fly girl.
Yep,
I just thought I'd read from the prologue and very different eras,
all of us, I guess. This is the 26th of January, 1808. 300 scarlet uniformed soldiers with fixed bayonets and loaded firelocks of the ready are marching through the rough dirt streets of Sydney. Some passing locals stop to stare at the troops being led by their New South Wales Corps band, playing a rousing rendition of the British Grenadiers on the fife and drums. Others scatter in terror. It's the 20th anniversary of the founding of one of Britain's newest colonies, and one soldier's bellow that this will be the most glorious day in the Corps' history is met by a cheer from the ranks. These men in battle dress with their colours flying rebellion in their hearts are on their way to overthrow the colony's governor, the notorious William Bligh, but when they reach the cast iron gates of Government House, they halt. Standing behind the bars is the lone figure of a small, slim woman, dressed in a black frock and bonnet. Mary Putland does not move to allow them in. She simply stares steadily into the eyes of the man at the head of the battalion. For a moment, Major John George Johnson hesitates. "Madam," he says, finally gathering his wits, "move aside. We have not come for you, we have come for your father." "Well, you shall not have him," she replies. "Go back to your own homes and your own families. Leave this instant." Johnston, commanding officer of the Corps, the first man ashore in the First Fleet, and the celebrated hero of the battle against an armed pack of convicts that outnumbered his men 10-1, again wavers. He'd expected the governor to be here himself with his guards, his staff, or a crowd of his supporters. He hadn't envisaged Bligh's daughter being the sole sentry brave enough to face his troops. He reaches for the bars of the gate, but still Mary refuses to yield. He shouts an order. There's a clatter through the ranks, and the men ranged behind their commanding officer raise their muskets to their shoulders. Mary doesn't flinch. Instead, she raises her furled white silk parasol above her head, and as the soldiers push the gate open and jostle their way in, she rains blows on their chest and their shoulders. "You traitors," she shouts, "you rebels, get back." "That damn Bligh girl," Johnson mutters, his frustration matched only by his secret admiration of her pluck. "She'll be the end of us."
Thank you.
So, firstly, again, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we meet and pay my respects to the Bidjil people, their elders past and present, and other First Nations people who are with us today. What you've seen from what we've heard from our authors is completely different stories, a completely different approach to historical fiction. But I'm just going to take us back to our theme for today, which is that historical fiction gives us the opportunity to examine and tell stories about the past. And this conference allows us to showcase a continuum of ideas and creativity, which I think is all the more important in not only the world events, but recent events in our times. So thank you. Now, again, I really loved these books. I do commend them. We've got Bellevue, set in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales in the 1970s. Alison has read about Claire Barclay inheriting Bellevue. Are you able to, just in a nutshell, without any spoilers, tell us what it is that Claire faces as she moves to the Blue Mountains?
Well, you've heard a bit about the background in the first bit that I read. So basically, Claire has had 12 years to recover from that frightful accident to her husband, when what really floored her after that was that he had done something to their finances before he died accidentally. And so she was left with nothing to live on and a small daughter. So the novel then actually begins with her inheriting the house. And at the time, this was set in early 1972, before the Whitlam government was even fought off, but anyway, it was early 1972, at a time when the second wave of feminism was beginning and Australia was just withdrawing from the Vietnam War. And it was also a time, it was a bit of a green revolution, because those of you who are from Sydney will know that that's just after the green ban, first green ban began in Sydney. So there's an environmental theme in this story. And so what Claire does when she moves to Bellevue is she knows that there are some documents there from her husband's estate, and she begins searching. And at the same time, she begins to build herself into the community, which becomes increasingly divided as developers have their eyes on her property, Bellevue, as well as on the whole village. And this is loosely based on a village in the Upper Blue Mountains where my parents used to live for many years and where we spent many holidays when I was growing up.
Thank you, Alison. So, again, alphabetically, Leah, the Doll's Eye shifts between Germany of 1933 and Outback Australia 5 years later. Are you able to, in a nutshell, without spoilers, give us a little bit of an idea of the themes and connections?
Thank you. It's basically at its heart, Doll's Eye is a love story, but it's also about secrets, and it's about, Doll's Eye is a medical term for a reflex that we check to see if people are conscious or not, depending on their eye movements. So I played with that trope in are we really seeing what we look at? It deals with the build-up to World War II in Europe, and the main character, Anna, is a young child at the beginning of the story, and it goes backwards and forwards in time and place, and she's unwittingly caught up in a budding Nazi spy in Landsberg, where Hitler is in jail writing Mein Kampf. And without giving too much away, she gets spirited away. Her father sees danger ahead, and she is basically finds herself in Australia with her doll collection. She is a doll collector from when she's a little girl, and applies for a job in the middle of the outback in a town called Burdham. So if you look at any old globes, you can see in the middle of the Northern Territory, if they're World War II or prior, Burdham is a prominent feature of a world globe. It doesn't exist anymore. It's a ghost town. And it was once a thriving tiny little town at the end of the North Australian Railway, which they were trying to build from Darwin, going down through to Adelaide, crisscross the country. It became very important during World War II as an army base and Air Force base. So I actually have done the whole trek through to find this ghost town following the railway tracks, which was another story in itself. But when Anna gets there, she has fled from the world. She wants to kind of run away from everything and start again, and finds herself with this job looking after the publican's family. And then when the wife dies and the children leave, she's running the Burdham pub, which was the centre of this tiny little town. And 5 years later, when she thinks all is safe, she comes across a visitor to town who was a Yiddish poet. I call him Alte Meister, which in Yiddish means old story. And it basically, these two people who have encountered themselves in the middle of nowhere fall in love, two very, very different people. And the story goes from there.
Thank you. Thank you. Sue, back to the earlier Joust.
Well, no spoiler alert. I won't tell you whether the Rum Rebellion succeeded or not. The story of Mary Bly is basically about when William Bly was appointed governor of New South Wales. He had a problem because his wife, Betsy, refused to come over with him to New South Wales because she said she got terribly seasick. But really, we kind of think she was needed back in London to keep networking and smooth over all the arguments that Bly had with everybody, really. And she was very much in charge of making sure that he continued to have a good reputation, because his reputation had been really sullied by the mutiny on the Bounty. He had many enemies because he was so ferociously proud and obstinate in so many ways. So he had six daughters, which was unfortunate for him because he really longed to have a son to follow his Navy career. So he decided his first daughter, his eldest daughter, had already got married and she was starting to have children. So he decided that he would take his second eldest daughter over to New South Wales as his consort. And as part of that, he introduced her to a young naval lieutenant. And the two of those started courting, much to Bly's joy and delight. And so therefore, he suddenly had an aide-de-camp after they got married. He had this package of the two of them to bring over to New South Wales, because unsurprisingly, nobody else agreed to come over with him as his aide-de-camp because everybody disliked him. He had a nephew, a favourite nephew, and he thought he would be his aide-de-camp. But the nephew went to sea once with Bly and afterwards said, "I'm never going to sea with that man again."
So Mary was dragged kicking and screaming, and her new husband, all they wanted to do was go to Ireland on his new estate and start a family, as young women wanted to do in those days. But she was dragged kicking and screaming over to New South Wales. And this is her story.
Thank you. So you're a journalist, we've heard. I'm going to ask each of you to answer these questions in your own way, but can you tell us about the mix of facts and fiction, and also the mix in your creativity and your day job? I mean, that's
sure.
A lot of questions, but what do you bring from your day job into this process of writing?
As a journalist, you're writing all the time, and obviously that kind of helps you, hopefully, to become a better writer. I mean, you can be the judge of that, really. But I, you know, somebody obviously said all writing is rewriting. And I think the more you write, the better you become. It's just like anything, swimming or anything. You kind of practice really improves what you're doing. So that really helps. And also it's helped me in other ways in terms of meeting people. I got my first literary agent because I was doing a story for a newspaper on Norfolk Island with Colleen McCullough, and she introduced me to my first literary agent. And sometimes I'd be interviewing people, and they might approach me later and say, would you be interested in writing a book? And so I've written lots of non-fiction books, 27 of those, and that's really helped me. But when it comes to historical fiction, it's probably much more of a hindrance, because you need to take time out for historical fiction. You need to absorb yourself in the time frame. And it can be really difficult. You're doing a Zoom interview with somebody. Yesterday I went to a prop tech conference. And then you're kind of having to go back to the late 1700s or the early 1800s. And it becomes really discombobulating. It becomes really quite confusing trying to skip times like that. So it can be really hard, and you end up doing so much non-fiction, it can be really difficult going back to fiction. And, you know, after doing so many non-fiction, I kind of find it kind of quite easy according to what the subject is. But I thought fiction would be so much easier because you just don't have to do the research. But of course, with historical fiction, it's the worst genre we can choose. You have to do the research, and then you have to strip away the research, really. So you just have this air of understanding the era, but you don't kind of have too much of the research in, and then you're just making up stuff, and that can be really difficult. And maybe a nonfiction book might take me 3 months to 6 months to write, depending on the subject. My first historical fiction, Elizabeth and Elizabeth, took me 5 years, and I thought I was going to die when I was writing it. It's just Elizabeth, the two Elizabeths followed me everywhere where I traveled, because I travel, do a lot of travel writing. They followed me everywhere, and they were kind of like this cloud over my head wherever I went. And I thought, I'm never going to get rid of them. And when I finished a book, I thought, I'm never going to do this again, because it's just too hard to combine reality with fiction and still kind of keep it very honest and truthful. And then, unfortunately or fortunately, it became a really good seller, and the publisher asked me for another one. And I thought, oh no, there's no way I'm going back to that. But then again, I thought, well, I've done all this work. I understand now that when people actually meet each other in early colonial Australia, they don't send each other an email or phone each other up and say, let's get together. They actually get on a horse and have to go to each other's houses. And I thought, well, look, I've learned so much now about colonial Australia. I should try. Maybe the next book won't take me as long. And happily, I've met Mary Bly in the pages of Elizabeth and Elizabeth. I've become fascinated by her courage and her relationship with her father. And I thought, I would love to try this again. And hopefully I won't make such a meal of the whole thing again. And it was fantastic, because I knew a bit more about what I was doing. And, you know, I bow to my two co-presenters who are much more experienced in this field than me. But it worked much better. And when the publisher came back and said, we'd like a third one, I wasn't so distraught. So I was kind of quite happy, really. Yeah.
Thank you. Leah, you've mentioned this book about flight from World War II and the past. And you've also mentioned that you're a physician, or I've mentioned you're a physician, and you've alluded to some of your discipline as a physician. Now, whereas with Sue, I can see the jump. What's the jump between a physician and the doll's eye? And also, your other writing, are you escaping from your job, or are you expanding on it? How are you inspired by your work?
I think they go hand in hand. You know, I in grade three, I had a poem published in the school magazine. And if the truth be known, you know, I've always been a good English student. And, my big secret is I got into medical school on my English and French marks, to be honest. So I've always loved reading. That I think my claim to fame in sport was a fifth ribbon in tunnel ball in grade three. So I used to hide in the library and read. So writing and reading, always they're part of my life. And then going through medical school, you know, you have to develop a certain amount of, well, I did, tunnel vision to get through. So a lot of that got set aside for 6 years. And then I found, as I was a young doctor, junior doctor, and we came back to reading and writing more as a sort of a solace for all everything I had been experiencing and couldn't put into words. But I think just to answer your question in a roundabout way, I think it comes from the same wellspring, because I think I'm a GP and I spend my life, I'm just so blessed because people come to me with their stories. You know, if I don't listen to their stories, I think I'm a pretty crappy doctor. So I've got this gift of people sharing their innermost thoughts and lives with me. And of course, you know, I can't just still those onto the page. They merge, they mix, they inspire me to create different sorts of a sort of pastiche of characters. But I think the main thing is that as a doctor, I always try to listen for subtext. So I'm listening as much to what the patient's not saying as what they're actually saying. And I think as a writer or as a reader in particular, that also applies. It's what's in the narrative that's sort of not actually being said up front, that you glean from that from your reading or writing experience. I think for me, I don't escape from one wall to the other. They're very much interwoven. I think I think probably being a doctor makes me a better writer. But I think more than that, and what's more important is that the process of reading and writing hopefully makes me a better physician. I think teaches to be listening better.
Thank you, Yuria. So, Alison, your book about a grieving woman forging a new life and running into conflict. So how's this tie in with your role as a professor of economics?
Oh, very easily.
And also, what are the connections between your day job and your books? You mentioned earlier that your parents had a property in the region of the book that you'd written. Were you drawing on your knowledge of that area, how does your work work in?
Well, I should say I'm a behavioural economist, but the difference between fiction and being a behavioural economist is that with the economics, you're looking at average behaviour in a different groups, but the average is within that group, whereas in fiction, which makes it similar but different, you're looking at the psychology of individuals. So whenever I meet anyone, I'm thinking about what makes them tick. And then you pick out one or two characters, or actually they come to you, and then you start working on telling their story. But I think for me, the big complementarity between economics and fiction is the plotting, that I really love plotting things. And when I first started out writing fiction, that wasn't an obsession of mine, but it's become increasingly so. And it's a real plotting, a complex plot is a really tricky thing. And I think the analytical skills that I learnt as an economist help with working out where the story is going. There are, to answer your other questions, I'm not sure whether to make a confession at this point. I think I probably should. My first degree was in architecture. So it was a big shift from architecture to economics and then to fiction. But I think anybody reading my books would see that the architecture comes through and the landscape comes through. And so in this book, when I was quite young, my mother and I were walking through, we were actually walking through Blackheath, and we saw a house that we both fell madly in love with. This was before I decided to do architecture. And so that the architecture feeds through into a strong visual element in the books, plus the fact that my sister and I, we were brought up to be very conscious of the landscape and the environment. So that also comes through in the story. And what I find quite interesting about when I look back over my books, and they're all different, and yet I realized quite recently that I'm writing out bits of my history, not explicitly. It's just that they come through in different books unconsciously. You know, I've only recently realized that. So there's lots of stuff connecting.
So we've seen three very different eras, very different stories, very different authors, and very different drives. So I don't think we're going to be able to answer the question about the day job and the connection between the day job and writing, but maybe we can ask another question, which is why I always come to writers' festivals. I always want to know the answer to this question, which is, how do you do it? How do you do all this writing? I mean, what are the disciplines you use? What is the routine, or do you not use a routine? Do you wake up at, 4 o'clock in the morning and write for 2 hours every day, or do you write in blocks, or do you shut yourself away for a week in the Blue Mountains or something? So, Leah, what are your routines?
Pretty all over the place. I'm not a very disciplined person. Once I get an idea for a book, then I'm a bit unstoppable in terms of my passion for getting those words on the page. The inspiration for Doll's Eye, I was visiting a dear friend of mine who'd invited me to, she just recently moved to the south of France and said, come and do some writing there. And Alice Nelson is her name, and she took me into a doll museum, which there was a little old lady sitting outside taking out tickets with her little lunchbox, and turned out I got talking to her and she'd had to move out of this house because her doll collection had gotten too big. So I walked in there and I just suddenly, one of those light bulb moments, I could hear the dolls talking to me and whispering, and I wondered, well, all these dolls, someone's loved them before, that there were children that loved these dolls and played with these dolls. And that I just knew in that moment that was my book, which is a gift, because you can spit in years not knowing what you're going to write. And from then on, I just, any moment I could, I just would grab and go down the rabbit hole of research and trying to draw it together. And I was very lucky with this novel. My publisher at Penguin is the wonderful Meredith Curnow, and I basically, pitched her a synopsis and a chapter. She said, go for it, Leah. I do most of my writing if I've been fortunate enough to, be awarded a residency or something. So I wrote a lot of this book in
the backwoods of Scotland, at Cove Park, which was a fellowship through Varuna, the writer's house in the Blue Mountains, in exchange. So I just sat there with the sheep for four and a half weeks and belted out a first draft.
Fantastic. Alison, how do you write? What's your discipline, and how do you deal with breaks and juggling your academic life?
Well, when I first started out, I would try and write a bit every day. Not many words, you know, maybe 300 words on a good day, 1,000 words. But I had to do that because I was at that stage of my academic career when I couldn't afford to take off much time. In fact, I was head of department when I started out, and it was, I should also mention that I'm married to a fellow academic, and we both work, you know what academics are like, they work all the time, very obsessive. And
Tim, you hardly did anything on holidays and stuff.
That's what the parents-in-law thought. Before they knew about Tim's behaviour and mine, no, academics work obsessively, and we certainly do, so that if we don't have anything to work on, we feel a bit at loss unless we're out walking or something. So I think I digress somewhat. You wanted to know the working pattern.
Oh, yes.
Oh, lately, with the novel I'm working on at the moment, I thought I'd try an experiment and try writing it, dictating onto my iPhone when I'm doing something or other, because I wanted to see what the novel would look like if it were entirely like a play in dialogue. None of the in-between bits. And I could start to see where it was going and how it was evolving. And I thought, okay, I'll continue with that and add in the other bits later, if it works. And of course, there are times when I've been working on this draft, I've just felt like throwing it out the window. So I think at different stages, you can, depending on your other calls and what your time, you can choose different ways of getting your ideas down.
Thank you. And Sue, your routines.
Yeah, I'm amazed at that. I mean, you sound like Barbara Cartland, who used to just, you know, put on. Well, as a journalist, I'm really deadline focused. I seem to live all my life according to deadlines. And I think with every single book I've done, I've kind of had lots of journalist deadlines. So I start doing all these, I think I'll just do all these stories, get rid of them, and then I'll start work on the novel or I'll start work on another book. And it never works, and always, because you end up getting more and more work. So in the end, I just start on the book and I get so obsessed by it, I start getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning so I can work for 5 hours until 9 o'clock when the phone rings. And I mean, that sounds amazing, going to a cabin in Scotland and just working, but it's just never quite worked for me. I once went to a friend's holiday home on the coast. And I stayed 3 days and I had to leave because I got so lonely and I can't cook and I just didn't have anything to eat. And all the local cafes were closed for the winter. And I thought, this is disaster. I live in King's Cross. I can go and eat anywhere. So I just came back home again. But so it's really a bit erratic. But before, when I was doing some books for Penguin, I loved it because the publisher at Penguin would phone me up and say, "You should be halfway through the book by now. How are you going?" And I'd think, "I haven't started it yet." But I'd say, "Oh, it's going really well." And then I would get so scared, I would start really, really working. And then, unfortunately, these two historical novels with Alan and Unwin, and they never phone me up and ask me how I'm going, which is this bad. But I get to the point where I start thinking, I've really got to get this book in quickly. I'm doing a third one now, and it's got to be in by the middle of January, and I've written 8 lines. So I go through this process. Every single book is pathetic. I think I should have learned from this, where I start dividing everything up into weeks and days and working out how many words I have to do every day.
And then I get so scared, I really start working and I start turning away other journalists' work and just start really getting so absorbed in the book. And I just kind of then work with it, which is a ridiculous way to work, really. Working through fear rather than the joy of, you know, involving yourself in words. But it seems to work for me, really.
Well, that's good. We've heard really quite different approaches, and I think it comes down to what works for you works. So now we're going to go to questions in the last few minutes. I've got an online question, and this is for Alison. I love plotting too. Do you find it a challenge to move from the fun of plotting to the grind of writing scene by scene, line by line?
Ooh. No, I don't really, because I think the plot is very hard. And it's a bit like, you know, getting started is difficult, but if you've got a plot, that's a start. And then if you think you've solved the plot, then you think, well, you know, I've almost finished. Or I just have to add all those in-between bits that take weeks and weeks and weeks. So, yeah, so that's my strategy.
Thank you. Now, any questions from the floor? Yes. Sorry, I'm also the roving mic, so you're going to have to come up to the thank you. And then I'll take the gentleman behind next. Thanks. So
I just wanted to ask about your process. Do you start with research, or you start with plotting, or you're writing first draft and then you go in research when you actually know what you need to research? What is the process?
So I start researching first, but I try not to get too involved in researching, because researching is so pleasurable. And you can just end up researching, and never actually writing a word on the page. My partner's really interesting because he's a writer as well. He just writes and then he researches later. And he doesn't do very much research either, really. But I kind of think if you can get a balance, you do some research, you start writing, and then you realize the gaps in your knowledge. And then you kind of research and fill it in, because otherwise researching, you go down every single rabbit hole and it becomes a real excuse for not actually getting down to work. A very good friend of mine is a researcher and he wants to write books, but he researches so many different subjects, he never gets round to actually writing anything. And I think that's with historical fiction, it is so easy to do that. Because the pleasure of research, and the more you learn, the more you become intimidated about writing historical fiction, because you realize how much you don't know. And then you're always worried that maybe you'll miss out something really important. So it's a kind of a balance.
Next question. Sorry. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm just curious when each of you started your writing careers, and if you have children, how did you balance the role of writing and mothering and working full-time as well?
Let's start with Leah.
I was writing pre-children. I have three that are grown up now, but it's a juggle, and I guess they also were a huge inspiration for me. I mean, I think my kids have been a very big part of the process of writing. A lot of the writing gets done on the kitchen table, or used to get done on the kitchen table. And if I was sort of, you know, up against a deadline and editing, sometimes, you know, in my desperation, I just go into the bathroom and lock the door to the final edits. Their mummy's kiss. And I've got a very, very supportive partner. You know, their father's always stiffed up when I've been, you know, my back's against the wall. I just want to actually come back quickly to that previous question. I was two cents words to put in. I'm a pantser, and so I don't plot. I have no idea what my books are going to be about, nor do I really want to. As frustrating and as much for struggle that is, that would kill the excitement for me. So it's that joy of kind of researching and writing and just seeing it evolve a bit like a magic carpet unfurling.
And only at the later stage of drafts, and you know, that's probably draft 5,000, do I actually understand more or less what I'm writing about. But the kids help in that process too. The kids, when they started growing up, would say, oh yeah, well that fits, why don't you do that? And sort of that little, over the dinner table, and we're discussing, you know, what I'm actually writing. So the kids can be very much part of the project.
Thank you. Alison?
I've got two grown-up daughters, and they both decided very early on that they didn't want to become economists because they thought, I think they thought in part they might turn into Tim and me and work all the time. So I'm exaggerating, we don't work all the time actually, but the having the children I found, well, just wonderful obviously, but it does hold you back a bit. But what it does do, which I think is a really important thing, it makes you use your time effectively. So, you know, as soon as you probably all know, if you've had children, that as soon as you have a child, you've got to take advantage of every free moment when the child is asleep or at school. And that too is an advantage, I think, in terms of time, what economists call time management.
Sue, I was at a conference once and somebody said, stood up and said, how come you've written so many books? And I said, because I don't have children. She said, right. So I think, well, obviously it's wonderful to have kids. I never had children. And I kind of quite miss not having that grounding stuff that people, the parents do have. But I always had the grounding from my parents who never read anything. And I said to my mum once, she said, oh, what are you doing? I said, I'm doing this book about this woman called Mary Bly, and she did this. And my mother said, oh, okay, that's interesting, although she was clearly not interested at all. And she said, it sounds a bit historical. And I said, well, it is. And she said, oh, I don't like history. And she said, but so what's this woman doing now? And I kind of thought, well, I don't need so much the grounding from children. I've got it in my parents.
Okay, any more questions? No? Have you got any questions of each other?
I thought you were going to ask us if we ever thought about giving up our day job.
Oh, was I? I don't know. I don't know. Okay, just imagine.
I always think that that question means that, well, it's about whether or not you should keep writing. But in fact, yes, do you ever think about giving up your day job?
Yeah, sometimes. I was talking to Jock Saron the other night of the awards, and he's a lawyer. And when he started writing, he gave up his certificate of practice law, and so he could devote himself to writing. And I thought that was fantastic. But I guess really you have to be prodigiously talented or very confident, because unlike Alison, my first degree was in economics.
Oh, really?
And you often don't make very much money from books. So it's actually quite difficult, I think, to, you know, it's a balance. Should you give up your day job, you might end up writing more books. You might end up writing better books. Or you may end up not writing any books at all. I went to a conference once and a woman stood up on stage and she'd written a couple of really beautiful books. But she talked about how she lived, and she lived in this cottage in the country by a river, and it had no electricity because she didn't have any money. And every time she wanted a bath, she would drag an old tin bath down to the river, fill it up with water from buckets because she had no running water either, and she would light a fire and warm the water over a fire. And every time her computer ran out of electricity, she would get in her car and sit there for most of the night trying to charge up her computer. And I thought, wow, I mean, I'm very willing to suffer for my art. I don't think I could survive that. So it's always, I think, a balance between, you know, being able to support yourself and your family and having the time to write. And I think we're all very, very time poor, and we're probably all a bit cash starved as well sometimes from time to time, especially at the moment. So it just, again, like everything else in life, it's just a balancing act, and you never quite know whether you've got it right or wrong. You just have to kind of do your best, I think.
Alison, do you have anything?
Sorry, what was the question again?
Will you give up your day? Would you give up your day?
Oh, well, I'm at the end of my academic career. Being emeritus professor means you'd no longer have to lecture. You can carry on doing research projects that you want to do. So really, life's a breeze.
And Leah?
Even if I was in a position financially to do that, I don't think I'd want to, because I think I'd go potty if all I was doing is writing 24/7. You know, my brain just goes to crazy places with research and that. And I think for knowing that I've got that day job is very grounding, and I wouldn't want to give up that interaction with wonderful human beings that I am privileged to meet being a doctor. As a writer, I'm sort of sitting in my little room, kind of cut off from human contact. So I think it keeps me very grounded.
Yes,
and I'm very privileged that I, you know, it pays the bills and, you know, folks and kids out.
Well, all three of you have been wonderful to hear from, because you're telling us how it works. I think I was selected to lead this discussion because, you know, I always use my day job as an excuse for not doing more writing, and my writing is an excuse for not doing better in my career. So I've managed to use it to block both paths, but it looks as though there is another way of doing it. So thank you very much, both.
As all to you for your applications, your inspirations. Now everyone go out and buy their books and read them. And
they're fantastic. They're really beautiful books. Thank you again. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast, held from the 2023 HNSA conference held in Sydney. Just a reminder that 2025 is conference year and details will soon be announced. Visit our website hnsa.org.au, join our Facebook group, and subscribe to our newsletter to be up to date. And please explore our podcast archive, treasure trove of historical ideas. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.